You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. This week we present the first in several installments of recordings that I made of my panels and events at Dragon Con 2015 in Atlanta. It was a great convention, one of the most fun yet, one of the best Dragon Cons I can remember, and this was my 21st year of attending Dragon Con, my 18th non-consecutive over 21 years. And I was able to do quite a few different panels, either as moderator or panelist or the host of some sort of a game show type event. We'll get into a few of those before the fall is over. I'll post a few of those. But we're going to kick things off with probably the most prestigious thing that I got to do this year. You've heard my interview with Larry Niven and you 2 years ago, and you should have gotten to hear my interview with Harry Turtledove last year. Both times the sci-fi literature track had me up in the ballroom, in the main ballroom where they have their big guests like Larry Niven and Harry Turtledove, and I was asked to be the person to ask the questions and kind of moderate, and it was quite an honor, and I really appreciate it. This year I got a nice, good recording of my interview with Peter F. Hamilton, the British space opera author, New York Times best-selling author of these, I call them above-average-length books, and Peter has kind of a humorous response to that. Peter is the author of such great works as the Night's Dawn trilogy that began with Reality Dysfunction, the Void trilogy, that concluded with The Evolutionary Void, and Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained, a great duology book there. Really one long story, as he says, that he broke in half for the publishers. Among quite a few other, Great Northern Road, quite a few other works, and we'll talk about some of them here, and the audience has some good questions too. But I was also joined by Scott McGlasson. He is the moderator of the Facebook groups for space opera and space opera writers. And I sort of talked him into going this year, and he met me at the airport. We flew down there. We kind of hung out together as much as we could over the weekend, given that we had differing schedules. And we had a lot of fun. So, without further ado, let's get into it. Here is Peter F. Hamilton at Dragon Con 2015. Interviewed by me, Van Allen Plexico, and Scott McGlasson.
All right, Dragon Con 2015, hello! We are here with superstar space opera science fiction writer Peter F. Hamilton.
Afternoon.
I am Van Allen Plexico. I will be your host here on Fantasy Island. I'm stuck in a chair that's messed up. I am the author of the Sentinel superhero novel series and the Shattering space opera series, among other things, and I host the White Rocket podcast. And I have my assistant, left-hand man today with me, the moderator of Facebook Space Opera and Space Opera Writers Group, Scott McGlasson.
Yay. Oh, yeah, awesome.
So between the two of us, we should be able to hopefully ask Peter some interesting questions and entertain you guys and inform you guys for the next hour. So we'll see how it goes. All right. Okay. So what we decided to do is I'm going to ask a couple of questions first, just kind of general writing questions, so we can kind of get a sense of how you do your job, and then Scott is going to dig in a little deeper into some of the particulars, some of the specifics. So why don't we start out and you just tell us, I think we can roll these two together. How did you end up doing what you do? And then we'll say, how do you do what you do? Yeah.
Why do I do what I do?
Why is it to make us happy?
Why did I start?
Yeah, how did you get started and how did that happen?
I grew up in Rutland, which is this amazingly rural area in the UK. Don't get me wrong, I love it. I mean, I still live there. But I grew up as a teenager in the 70s, and there is nothing to do in the 70s anyway, let alone in the rural area. And I found the science fiction section in the library, and that was it. I was out of there. I was in interstellar space. I was in interplanetary space. And that's when it came to me to start writing. There was never any question of what else I would do but science fiction. And that is the why of it, because of the escapism and the scope that science fiction gives you to write with. That's a fairly brief answer. But that is why, when I started writing, it was always going to be science fiction. Mm-hmm. The how of it, people have this assumption that writing is this incredibly romantic profession that will strain away and do a paragraph and then go and lie down and have a drink for the rest of the day. It's not like that. It's a 9-to-5 like anything else, especially if you want to be a commercial writer and keep churning them out once every year or 18 months, which is what the marketing department loves. I'm making it sound a little bit too commercial. But I do the 9-to-5. I help drop the kids off at school in the morning. I'll go home and write, have lunch, write some more, and go and pick the kids up in the evening. And when I say that, when my wife's around, I get very dirty looks. What do you mean you pick them up in the evening? Having said that, I mean, it is and weekends are sort of family time, but when deadlines get nearer, I tend to work later into the night, and Saturdays and Sundays kind of vanish. And that's the routine. It is a 9-to-5, however ordinary that sounds.
Well, okay, so if you have it down to just like a process like any job, then tell me this, because this is certainly true with me. There come times when it really gets rolling. You're really cooking, right? Things are going. How does that then change? Do you have to tell your family, go ahead and eat without me, or, you know, how does that happen?
It is a fairly regular thing. I mean, in the morning, I will read through what I did yesterday. I will then go through it, polish the prose as best I can, change a few things so you'll know that needs changing. So come lunchtime, come the afternoon, mentally I'm at where I left off yesterday and just carry on writing. And I have a couple of hours leeway in the afternoon, evening. So if it's going really well, I can keep on doing it. And sometimes I will go back after, you know, kids are in bed or whatever. So it is a bit flexible. But it is this fairly regular thing. And the discipline does help. A lot of people say, you know, how do I become a writer? What do I have to do and everything? And I had this discussion with a friend of mine. And there are three things that you need. Fairly self-obvious, the first two is, one, you have to be able to write a sentence, a paragraph, whatever. You actually have to be able to write. Two, you need to be able to tell a story. And three, you have to have the discipline to sit down every day and write. Now, a lot of people have any two of those in any combination. The ones of us that have all three of those, we're the ones in the bookshop. So it is this combination of requirements, if you like, to be a writer.
Yeah. I was mentioning to you a while ago that I just recently had a conversation with Graham McNeil on the show, and he had one interesting observation that I wanted to see what you thought about this. He said that at the end of the day, because this ran counterintuitive to kind of how I had always been doing it and what I thought was the wise approach, but he said at the end of the day, when he's writing a section that he feels good about and it's really going, he tries to stop for the day before he gets to the end of that section so that when he comes back, he can instantly pick back up, whereas he feels like if he finishes it, it takes longer to kind of get started again the next day. How do you feel about that?
He's probably right, yeah. My end time is fairly flexible. If it's going well, on those rare days it goes really well, I will keep on writing. Mm-hmm. But I know I will actually do the. I will tend to finish the section because I don't want to run out of that train of thought. I don't want to go back the next morning and then have half a day catching up again.
Catching back up.
I will finish it. This goes. We're back to process again. I when I'm starting a project, I tend to do quite a lot of series, although I do the occasional standalone book. It will take me 3-4 years to do 2 books. So the first 6 months is purely notes and plotting. So I know exactly what is going to happen every day. I know where the character is when I start, and I know where I've got to get them to at the end of the chapter. And I have to have that. And I was sitting up here with Laurel K. Hamilton the other day, and she just looked at me and said, I cannot write like that. There is no set way to write. I mean, I know some people who sit down with a completely blank page and just start typing page on chapter. I envy them, they envy me. There is no correct way to do a novel. But that is the process I have to have, because of the complexity of what I'm doing.
Oh, exactly. Right. I would say that, and that kind of leads me into the last question. Then I'm going to let Scott talk some specifics. You are known certainly for writing books that are longer, maybe than average, and that have lots of characters, lots of major characters, B plot, C plot, a lot of stuff going on, and that's awesome because it has like the complexity of a long running TV series or movie series or something like that. What is it about that kind of storytelling that appeals to you more than something that maybe would be shorter or simpler or whatever? What is it that made you say, that's the kind of thing I'm going to mainly do?
Longer than average. That's so polite. again, we're down to the kind of subjects I write on. If you are threatening an entire galaxy, that is not a story you can tell in 200 pages and with 2 characters. I write about change a lot. I want to look at... There's obviously some big event, some threat to the galaxy, some threat to the planet, whatever. Now, the heroes and the villains battling it out for the resolution is fine and wonderful and makes great drama. I am also very interested in the effects, the knock-on effects, what has to the little guy, how it affects society as a whole, how society will change and come out of this conflict. I mean, conflict is good drama. But what will it do to ordinary lives? And I think that is why I have the sort of, if you like, the B-level characters, which is the everyman character.
Right.
And I think that is what tends to attract people to my work, is that they can see themselves in a lot of these situations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Scott, take over for a little bit. You have some questions about that you want to throw in.
Well, he had mentioned the world building and how meticulous you spend time doing your world building, and you take a lot of time doing it. And one of the things that when we talked about it a couple days ago, when you mentioned that to me, I thought, well, okay, everybody's familiar with Reality Dysfunction, the trilogy. Not the first chapter, but when you kick off with the Lysif or the Lilsif.
Yeah, Lysif.
Which are basically the impetus for everything that happens.
Yeah.
The meticulous description of the planet that they inhabit, which is actually a moon of a gas giant, if I remember right.
Yeah.
And it was tidally locked, so the weather was a factor in their evolution.
Yeah.
They evolved with... There was almost a race memory because they didn't have very long lives, but they would extrude these pellets of memories, then the next generation would pick them up. Okay, so it was, and I went back and I read that section. I was like, this is very detailed. This is all hyper detailed. How long did it take you, like, just for that one bit? Do you remember, I mean, how you sat down and how long it took you to put that together? And by the end of the Reality Dysfunction, did you have to go back and revisit it to change it up a little bit, or once you were done with it, were you done?
I'm so glad you're asking me questions about what I did in 1994.
we'll get to the new stuff. That's just the one that hit me. I'm trying to tie it in.
No. I do remember doing that because that, from memory, a lot of data was coming in from Jupiter, and they have the Io flux tube, which follows Io around. There's this huge electrical storm between Jupiter and Io, and that played a big part in this.
Right.
So I was kicking it off from original science. And I knew what the aliens had to do. And so the planet basically evolved to provide the aliens with an evolution. And because we just started to find out plenty more about Jupiter, that played in very nicely. So all my stuff has this interwoven of real science and playing with it to turn it into what I want, using the knowledge base we have. So that is the kind of process. It is an organic process. You ask what comes first. There's one or two ideas which then spark other ideas, which then evolve other ideas, which build up the planet as a whole. you know, if it needs to have this specific weather, then it has to be tightly locked, and all this kind of thing just locks together for me. But it does take, you know, a week or so to decide this kind of thing.
And get it down? I mean...
Yeah, oh yeah, it was all down on paper.
I mean, you can't just leave it.
No.
You've got to get it done.
My memory is not that good.
Okay, so jumping to something that's more recent, Great North Road, sort of a crime sci-fi, sort of a... That I was going to ask you about. Obviously, you're a fan of solving crime, of the not necessarily the CSI type stuff. Maybe I mean, is that a big factor into it?
I was a CSI fan. Yeah, actually, one of the last Greg Mandel thing I wrote was actually a novella, which won an award back in 2000. And one of the reasons it was never reprinted was that the DNA technology just overtook the story.
Oh.
I did rewrite it last year as a sort of commemoration piece, and I think it's available on ebook. But it just completely, the DNA, what we know about DNA testing just overtook that story entirely.
Well, when you sat down to write Great North Road, you had the crime that they're trying to solve. Which you had mentioned to me that you had actually gone down into the town and walked around.
It's set in Newcastle, the Earth part is set in Newcastle, where my family comes from. And that point on the riverbank is the perfect place to dump a body, if anybody needs to. So, those streets are the real streets, and that is how the town locks together. Now, the UK has... It was a reputation, it's a fact, as the most surveilled society on the planet. I mean, we have CCTV everywhere. Now, I'm just, again, this is what science fiction does, I was extrapolating where that is going, and we're getting this smaller and smaller electronics down to smart dust. They're already talking about smart dust. So in this future, everything is just coated with smart dust, and you are under constant surveillance. So the fun part becomes, then, if you're going to kill somebody, how the hell do you do it when everything is being surveilled? And that was where the whole police procedural came from, is how, if you do find a body, how they will always track it back to you. You have to have a very good organisation, you have to be a criminal gang, basically, to circumvent this. And so how do they do that? And then how do the police, who know their methods, get past that? And it's this constant build-up of police versus gangs. And that is how the procedure came in.
One more question.
I believe Werner Vinge said in one of his books that when a society becomes completely under surveillance, basically within immediately almost, it's the singularity and it's all gone and everything. It's just, in other words, you can't get to that point without society falling apart. So it's almost reverse of how they...
Well, it's also... I don't know about falling apart, it can also lead instantly to dictatorships.
Right.
The other thing that this society had was that it was a cashless society. So therefore, the government can track every transaction, therefore you cannot cheat on your taxes. Therefore, we had what I called secondaries, which is for every contract you get an under-the-table payment made to a bank in Vietnam or whatever, and you have your actual credit card and your Vietnam credit card.
That's right.
Somebody is paying for goods with a Vietnam credit card, and the government doesn't know it's you. So you get your money that way. Mm. For every step they take, we always find a counter to it, if you like. And I think that reflects off
like an arms country. Race.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. It's an arms race.
To the readers, everybody that's read your work, and I have this conversation constantly with other sci-fi people that maybe haven't read your work or have and disagree with me, which they're wrong. I've always found that the primes from the Commonwealth sequence or the story, just the best villain in science fiction, bar none. I don't know if you guys agree with me, but I mean, from conception to how they act, their background, the intricate detail of their evolution, which we got to see, all the way up to a good old human autopsy, which was really good. I hope I'm not ruining that for anybody. Everybody's read it, right? So, going back to origin points, with the primes, what was the kernel of idea that set you off, and then were there any others that you took in from outside sources that helped you build their... their outlook, or was it pretty much just a kernel that just grew like they do, kind of just spread?
Yeah, it was, and of course they don't think they're the bad guys.
What's that?
They don't think they're the bad guys.
That's right.
We are the bad guys for them. It grew up from that, isn't it? With that story, I wanted to revisit the classic alien invasion. I think I said this the other day, is that from what we know of technology, if you have the technology to travel between stars, be it FTL or slower than light, you're not going to come here and invade us for our gold and our women. We know that now. It's not an economic reason or even a biological reason. Therefore, there must be another reason. Now, it's either possibly a religious reason, they're trying to convert us or whatever, or there is this reason that the prime have, is that they consider themselves the only life, the only viable and valid life. Therefore, everything else is just a disease almost, and they need to eradicate. We are occupying space, valuable space that they could live in. Therefore, we must be eradicated. And to them, that is perfectly logical and obvious, and they don't have human conscience. So that from working from what they had to be, you again work backwards almost. How did this come about? What kind of outlook do they have? Why do they have this outlook? What environmental, biological factors can influence that and build it? So it's reverse engineering, if you like.
That's very interesting.
Let me ask you this then. I love Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained. Fantastic. And I was curious, because you tend to write trilogies, maybe. I mean, certainly the Void trilogy comes to mind, the Night Stone trilogy comes to mind. So how did Pandora's Star, Judas Unchained end up being two books? Was it just going to be one really long book and you divide it in half, or did you just decide it fit, just came out?
They're all one book.
Okay.
The physical, practical nature of them means you have to split them into two or three, the way I write. I have done a couple of standalones. But yes, it is one book with a fairly good cliffhanger ending at the end of book one. But no, it was one story. It is always one story.
Because I know that, I believe in the United States at least, when Night's Dawn first came out in paperback, it was in like six volumes.
In America, it's a six-volume trilogy. In Italy, it's a 12-volume trilogy.
Redefining trilogy right there in front of us all. It's amazing, yeah. So... So I'm trying to think if there's any other... We haven't really talked about your influence. You talked about that you like to read, that what you had to do when you were younger was you read a lot of science fiction and everything. When you look back at kind of the writing tree that you feel like you kind of come out of, who do you look back to your main roots?
The origin stuff, the first stuff, was basically the classics, Heinlein, Asimov, Clarke, some Bradbury. John Wyndham was a bit of an influence as well, Day of the Triffids guy. I progressed up to more slightly more modern stuff, Larry Niven. I'm trying to think. And then it sort of tailed off at the end of the 70s. And then Julian May's Saga of the Exiles came out.
Oh, love that.
See a lot of people nodding at that. Yeah, that was a game changer for me. That again sort of brought me back into the fold of science fiction. Somebody was writing stuff I really like. Today, I always say I'm well-read up until the point I started writing. And you just lose time. Now I have kids as well, and I have, I managed to read something on the plane coming over. Hooray. that was Gibson's latest, by the way. That was the standard kind of influences. And of course, I know a lot of science fiction writers today, and to tend to read people I know, which is nice, but not necessarily a good thing.
It's a bit awkward, isn't it?
It is.
I know him. He's got books.
And do you read them?
I haven't read them yet.
He keeps promising, so we'll see.
I bought them. I just haven't read them.
Bless you.
Yeah. It tends to be kind of people I know, and I should get out of that habit. Not that they're not good, but need to widen the horizon.
I'm not sure how you would answer this. It'd be interesting. I grew up reading basically whatever Del Rey published, American 1970s and 80s science fiction. Okay, I didn't read a lot of British, European, any other international science fiction. The last 10 or 15 years, I read more British science fiction than I do anything American. How do you view, and again, we just said that you're not able to read as much now, so that understood, how do you view the differences between the two, if any, and how it currently is?
Oh, that's interesting. I was actually on the panel yesterday, I think it was, the the British SF panel and why is it different. And I think it does. It is kind of a reflection of culture. I know military SF is very popular over here. And we were trying to discuss why this is. And it's still set in the far future. It's like you've militarized space opera. You've slightly gone that way, whereas I've gone more interested in the cultural effects of it, if you like. The cultural impact of technology has on society fascinates me. And I use the big space opera to explore that. Whereas your conflict is possibly a bit more direct. And I'm not sure how to define it or why to define it, but I do think it defines the difference in our cultures, if you like. It's this thing divided by a common language.
Well, you know, let me add this in to the mix. British military science fiction, I think of like the Black Library stuff. I think of Warhammer 40,000, which is sort of a gothic, you know, it's almost a fantasy rather than here is more Tom Clancy hard tech military.
And you're also getting into what is now a tech thriller, you know, 20 years ago would have been science fiction. Right. I mean, the definitions are changing every day.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Scott, you got one more, and then we'll go.
Well, actually, I just realized that there's something about the primes that I forgot to ask. And if you're leaving pretty soon, so if you get out of here without me asking this, towards the end of the Void trilogy, for those of you, I hope everybody's read it, and I hope this. I mean, now I'm wondering if I should even ask the question. They're supposed to be, you know, you don't hear about them after Judas Unchained until almost the end of the Void trilogy, and then it's just a barest hint. So the question would be, are they still out there? Because obviously Nigel didn't get all of them. There was just a hint of them that there were prime ships, or prime designs at least, mixed in with the fleet that was heading towards Earth.
You are correct.
Okay.
In which case, you're going to have fun at the start of the next book, Night Without Stars.
Oh, see? That made my weekend. I'm good.
And see, Scott, sell some more books now, like you weren't going to give anyway. All right, well, let's see what the audience thinks about all this. If you guys have got questions, and did they set us a microphone up, or you want to just stand up? Or yeah, we have one right there, so if you guys want to go over to that microphone right there, then that would be awesome. Please come, go ahead and knock yourself out.
Don't be shy.
No.
Science fiction fans shy, yeah.
Hi. So I love your books, but as I kept reading the Void trilogy over and over again, it just kind of came to me, and I know this is probably something we couldn't really cover at the end of the book, but I just wanted to know if you thought about it. Would the Void disappearing at the end, doesn't that kind of doom the entire galaxy to start spreading apart with no gravity?
No, I think you're still left with a lot of supergiant stars, and they will reform a genuine black hole, I think.
Okay.
Given that the mass is there, and the mass always comes together. It will be a smaller giant. Every galaxy has a supergiant black hole at its center, as far as we know. Certainly the spirals do. If there are any astronomers in here, if you'd like to step in quickly. but given you've got this gap, then the outlying stars that survive will then be drawn together, and another supermassive black hole will form.
Okay. Yeah. I figured there was an answer. I just kind of wondered.
Okay. Yeah, no. That's my take on it. Like I say, if there are any astronomers, good.
If y'all have a question, I'm going to go ahead and get up there so we can move along.
Sure. I knew a lot of your work sort of fringes on hard sci-fi and maybe crossover. Can you talk a little bit about your research and how you go about that? What sources you pull in?
Right. I have this 6 month period of when I'm putting something together. That's when I'm putting it together. I'm kind of looking what technologies I'm going to need. And I read up on it. There's so much going on in every field. Like, there's no way I can keep current on everything. So I'm looking up, biology, computing, quantum computing, all this kind of thing, trying to see where we are and where we're going. And then doing what science fiction writers do and extrapolating that as best I can. I always have a kind of an advantage over the stuff written back in the 60s and 70s, and certainly before that. Clark's first book, Prelude to Space, is a lovely example of this. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the book, but he has an atomic rocket taking off from Australia, and it's a nuclear ramjet, which doesn't matter because the radioactive products are all in the desert. You know, and we've moved on from that. And he has the radio system has valves. Now, you tell anybody today under probably 25 that it's got valves, and they think you're talking about plumbing. Whereas I kind of have the advantage now of I can see where things are going better, so I will just use solid state. Now, whether that's quantum junctions, whether that's optronics, whether it's something else, it's just solid state. The key in science fiction, and FTL is the great example of this, is that when I do an FTL story, I need you to take this leap of faith with me, because this is how we get to new and strange and wondrous worlds, is it is a box like that with a button on it, and you press it and it works the way I say it does. Do not ever open the box and describe the circuitry inside. I get letters from you if I do that. So I will make it. I mean, I won't, apart from FTL aside, I won't break the fundamental laws of physics. I will try and keep it as believable and realistic as possible. And I will try and do as much research into a field as I'm writing about. I'm sure I've made a mistake. The great mistake I made in the Night's Dawn trilogy is that the Edenists have these amazing habitats in orbit around supergiants. Radiating out from them, because these are cylinders that rotate, radiating out from them are very long electrical conducting cables. Now, as you go through a magnetic field and you rotate, you're generating current, and that powers the habitat. If you actually do that, you don't get energy for free. It's decaying the orbit. Mm. We'll just gloss over that. Okay. But I did sort of know that, and I did get a few letters on that. But it's the fact that they did one of the shuttle experiments, one of the early shuttle experiments, was sending a cable out and seeing what kind of current it could generate through Earth's magnetic field. So it's based on that kind of tech, and just seeing how far I can push it and how far I can take it. So a lot of it has germs in today's technology, and just, as I say, extrapolating, which is great fun to do. But I won't. Try not to make it too outrageous and too unbelievable. Part of this 6-month process is we used to have science fiction, it was the problem in a society, and then the engineer would come, I'm simplifying horribly, but it would be the problem and the engineer would come along and fix it and the solution would be found. Today we can't really do that. Today I need a working functional society in which to base my situation, if you like, the story. So if you've got technology at a certain level that does these kind of things, how does it affect the economy? What politics will that result in? And so on and so forth. It's not just about the engineering. It's how the engineering affects society, which I find critical. Basically, on the fact that if I can't make it work in my head, I can't get you to at least accept what I've written.
Story for being, that was future-proofs your story.
Yeah.
So the technology will change and evolve, but the content of what you express is still germane to whatever time
you read. Yeah. I mean, this is also the terrific advantage of writing, you know, 500 or 1,000 years in the future. The early Mandel stuff I was writing, I wrote it 20 years ago, not really thinking what I was doing. What I was thinking, what I was doing, but not really thinking it through, was that it was set 40 years' time, and that is now 20 years' time. And I gave, for those of us who remember the 80s, we had firefaxes. Yeah? Everybody remember firefaxes? So I took that one step further and called them cybofaxes. Now, this was a wonderful book-sized gadget that you open, and it was a phone, it was a computer, or as we call it today, MacBook. you know, so that the technology has way gone past what I was talking about for 40 years, or now 20 years' time. But it's still the story will still hang together.
You called. Am I right in interpreting this when I was reading? I guess it was in the Judas Unchained books. They use the word array, and that basically is a computer, right?
Yeah.
That was the sense I always got. Why did you change the word, and what was behind it?
Because language changes. Everybody knows what a processor is. Would they still be called processors? We call things differently today. Mm. The language is constantly evolving. I want to give it again. This is part of the sense of the future. If There are some science fiction writers with terrific imaginations and invent, you know, 50 or 60 different words for a book to come up, and you need a glossary at the back. Now, I don't actually agree with that. If you come across a new word in something, datavize is the obvious one in Night's Dawn. The first time you come across it, you go, what? And then by the second and third time, the context will give you the word.
That's what I was going to say.
That is, to me, infinitely preferable than a glossary at the back. Who needs a glossary at the back to look up things? You have to introduce things, they have to make sense, and you have to do it in a way which isn't sort of looking down at your audience, if you like. You just bring it in as naturally as you can.
That was it exactly. The first time I encountered that word, I went, oh, what is the, and then the context went a couple of times, yeah. I'm like, oh, I think that's what
you've got it. Okay. This is one of the sort of great challenges of science fiction is, and it does tend to divide authors, is do you hit the ground running?
Mm-hmm.
And this was the Gibson book that I was reading on the way over. I mean, the first 20 pages of that is, whoa, what is going on? But it's William Gibson, so I stuck with it, and it pans out very obviously. And I have this—I do have an argument with some of my colleagues over this: is how much of a shock do you introduce in the first page or the first chapter? Because I know a lot of people who don't read science fiction, and you know, what do you do? I'm a writer. What do you write science fiction? Oh, I don't read that. Why not? Oh, well, I don't think I could. It's too difficult. It's too complicated. And that is a failure of the writer to not be able to lead. So anybody who can read historical fiction, anybody who can read crime fiction, where you're given a puzzle to solve, should be able to pick up a science fiction book and work out what datavize means and get carried along by the plot. And some of us sort of over-egg the mix and do this too big a jump in to a society that doesn't make sense or a problem that doesn't make sense. I do try to lead people in these days a little more gently. Great North Road is the sort of perfect example of, you know, the first line is not shocking. It's there's a big storm over Newcastle and you get in and the police car is a bit different to what you have today because it's got graphics on the windscreen. And then you gradually introduce the technology in a way that I would really hope that somebody who likes police procedurals could pick up. Go, okay, a little bit strange, but I'm understanding the process here. And that is the way I think, and it's a purely personal thing, and purely personal in the way I write, is that you don't do the big shock start. Whether there is no right or wrong about it, but that's just the way I prefer to do it.
Okay.
Anybody else going to hazard a question? I know you have some.
You know you want to.
Yeah, no, you want to be cool, don't you?
All the cool kids are
doing. All the cool kids are asking questions. Nobody?
No.
Yes, I have a...
God. I knew they did.
Nah, two of them. Go over there.
I knew they did.
Yeah. So,
or talk really loud.
Yeah, they can yell.
My question is, you have the technological aspect, but as you said yourself, you're interested in how the everyman is affected.
Yeah.
And also the cultural, the society, those aspects. And when I think of the Commonwealth Saga, and you cover all these different worlds from just almost outlandish to, you know, today transplanted.
Yeah.
The tone is more an observation, really, than a judgment or bringing your view into it. So I'm just wondering, you know, your view on society in the future, is that, you know, more utopic, more dystopic? Because you sort of have both in your book, but more... feel it's more we're observing the story take place.
Yeah, okay. The question for those at the back was my own personal opinion is, are we going the utopia or the dystopia way? Fair summary? Yeah. Personally, I'm an optimist. If you notice, every book does tend to end on a fairly optimistic note. It might be hell to get there. And I do put my characters through hell quite a lot because it's a lot of fun doing that. So I would say, I'll give you an honest answer about this. I regard today's society as transitory. I can't believe this is the best we can do. It's nice for us in the Western world. I can't believe this is all we can do. I believe we can do better. It sounds too pretentious, but I want to give people hope that we can achieve something better. And if this is the way I can do it in my small little way, then that's fine by me. I don't want to write polemics. I will try and... the story is all to me. It's a fun story. I want to entertain people. If I can put in just a few little lines that will make you go, didn't think of that before, and carry on enjoying the story, I've won. Okay, that is my goal in life. That, yes, we could maybe do that. Or why are we doing this when we could be doing that? Something like that. So I tend to shy. I know dystopias are very popular at the moment, but I will tend to shy away from them. I will want people to improve their life.
You know, that's it just occurred to me. I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. when you mentioned in the Commonwealth duology, there are mentions of isolated worlds,
yes.
Worlds where Nigel has pulled the plug on him and cut the gateway.
No, he didn't. They wanted isolation.
Did they?
They didn't want to be part of the mainstream. They're the real rebels.
Well, what I was going to say is, did you ever, as a writer, when you were working on that, did you ever go down any of those avenues and decide that you didn't want it in there?
One of the short stories in Manhattan in Reverse is set in, or is how one of these planets becomes isolationist.
Okay, there you go.
It's a Paula Meyer story.
I think that he made a good point there about you do sort of present these societies, but I mean, even the ones that are really bad, even like Morning Light Mountain, you just sort of present them almost objectively.
Yes.
And the reader kind of has to make their own judgment. I think that was you made that point, but I'm not sure it was clear all the way through. Okay. You just kind of leave it.
Politically, I'm fairly much in the middle of everything. I'm one of those, why can't we all get along guys? Having said that, I've been accused of everything from being a card-carrying Thatcherite to, well, obviously, he's a communist. So I figure if I'm annoying both sides, I'm doing pretty well. But that is the thing about it, is going back to the bad guys again, nobody thinks they're the bad guy. If I'm presenting a character who's doing something you would find abhorrent, I've got to give him a logic and a reason for doing so. I've got to argue his case and make it convincing. So this neutral presentation, if you like, is a key to it, is that that is the way that society evolves. If it causes a conflict within the book, fair enough, but I'm not saying I would like that one or I would like this one. These are options, okay? I'm not sort of... The author's opinion is not valid in that case. And it is amazing what people will read into my book that wasn't there.
Is it fair to say that people want to believe that you must have an opinion and you must be trying to tell
absolutely.
Us that, and they just can't believe that you're not foisting one on us?
The best example of this is my least popular book, which is Misspent Youth, which everybody took to be a big attack on the European Union. And they are wrong. And I'll tell you for why. It's a book about the first guy that gets rejuvenated. And youth always rebels against authority. And the authority at the time is he lived in the UK in England. And of course, it's a European government. Therefore, him and his son and all the teenagers are, you know, we hate the government and the government is the EU. Now, I always wind up what I wind up calling my Life of Brian conversation with this. Because I don't know what the public transport is like here. Ours creaks along barely. And in the book, the EU, the European Union, had invested in a whole load of money in our transport infrastructure. Therefore, you could catch a train to the middle of nowhere and then get a bus to a village. And the whole network just worked like that, which does not happen in the world that I live in the real world. So I'd be accused of going, oh, you're very anti-European about this. And I said, well, no, you know, come on, Europe's the thing that makes this work. Yes, but apart from the trains, what have you done? people will read in all sorts of things that are quite, I find quite bizarre.
Well, like
we're getting onto book criticism now, aren't we?
Like Huxley's Haven, as a matter of fact. Have you gotten both sides on that, on whether or not it's...
That was the argument I presented. Yeah, Huxley's Haven was the world where Paula Meyer came from. Now, Huxley's Haven was designed by a biological institute to make the perfect human society. Everybody on the planet, and it's a 1950s level of technology, everybody on the planet was designed to fulfill their job. A train driver wants to be a train driver, likes being a train driver, is happy being a train driver. A clerk is happy being a clerk, wants to be a clerk. So this society is incredibly rigid. It's like a caste system, almost. But everybody is happy in that. They have engineered a world that is as bad as good as a human society can get. So, of course, but you have to be born into this society. You're genetically reprogrammed for it. So people like us would come along and go, that is absolutely obscene. How can you do that? You're controlling people's lives. They have no freedom of choice. But the thing is, they're happy and they like it and it works. What right, therefore, do we have to come along and say, no, you can't do this, we've got to break it up, we've got to destroy it? And that's the kind of question that science fiction can pose, especially in the light of we are getting to the point of which you can have designer babies. And that is a huge thing. There's somebody offering, was it the eye colour or something already? That you can have your embryo tweaked. And of course, there's been an outcry about it. I think, was he Japanese or Chinese? Anyway, it was in the paper a few months back. But you see, and I, as a parent, if I was presented with a list of things I would like to improve, well, you know, maybe I'd like to make my kids a little more cancer-resistant, you know, not so prone to heart attack. It would be very hard to turn down that list as a parent. No congenital diseases, right. You know, male pattern baldness, tick. these are the kind of things we will be encountering. And this is what one of the things I love about science fiction is that we can put all these arguments and propositions out there. And there is no answer to this. You would have to make up your own mind, although society will impose its own morals, but then you go to a nice little Caribbean island that has a specialist clinic. And the rich will go there and have their designer baby. And this will very probably happen. Science fiction is not predictive as far as I'm concerned, but I can see that happening quite easily and quite dangerously. And is it eugenics? Is improvement eugenic? We don't know.
I believe we had somebody else with us. That's good. Yeah.
You've already kind of covered this, but if the farmers are one of the best animal villains, and Clint Bester has to be one of the best human villains. And I wanted to ask, what were the challenges in making someone who's completely unsympathetic but that compelling, and cracking up to do them?
Actually, one answer to that is a very old friend of mine, an editor, who sort of nursemaided me through my earlier short story years. Who just turned around to me and said, you've never actually written a convincing villain? Right. Quindexter was made by Banneth. You get to find this out in the Naked God. And he goes back to Banneth, who is this horrifying gang leader who experiments on her gang members. For those of you who've read it, you may have noticed on the wall of Banneth's room, her operating theatre, is a picture of a woman in a mid-19th century dress, Mary Shelley. Mm. She created a monster, and Quindexter came back and did what monsters do to their creators. So that was the sort of engineering or thought behind Quindexter, is that he has to epitomise evil, that he worships it, that is his raison d'etre. But he didn't. Nobody is quite that evil. He had to be made. I don't believe. Well, there probably are people who are pretty unpleasant out there. But that had to be. You can't get worse than this. And I think that was important for especially the Night Storm trilogy. I don't think I've written a human villain quite like that since. I mean, the cat wasn't pleasant. But Quinn was sort of the epitome of it. But like I say, he was manufactured. I can't think of circumstances, or there probably are, but there are not many circumstances that would turn something like that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
But we won't even make you stand up if you don't want to. Okay. Yes, sir.
So I guess this question is just kind of overall as a writer. How do you feel about audiobooks? Do you think they add something to your story, or do you prefer people to read your books versus audiobooks?
That's interesting. I've had more questions about audiobooks in America than I've had in 5 years of touring around England. I have no objection to them at all. I don't mind them at all. It is another way of getting my work, my words to my audience. It's the same with e-books versus ordinary books. I see no difference, basically. It's just a matter of getting it to you. I know it's a bit of a personal taste on the narrator, but I think my narrators do a pretty good job. So no, I have no. If you've got a long commute, car journey, or whatever, then that's an excellent way of listening to a book, of getting a book to you. I'm full of praise. I don't use them myself, actually. I tend to have the book or the Kindle, but because I don't have a long commute, I sort of walk over the patio to my office at the bottom of the garden. But yeah, no, it's just another way of getting a book to you, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, the question usually the argument comes in is some people don't consider that reading, and I argue that it is reading.
I'm with you. Yeah, that is reading. You're getting the words. What's their problem? Okay.
Sure. So in terms of world building, you usually start by, with a concept or a problem that you want to explore, or do you start developing a world and then things arise from it? You're talking about the surveillance state and whatnot, how you develop a world that has served the exploration of that problem. Like, is that a chicken and egg kind of thing? Like, what comes first? And further from that, when you're building a world out, you obviously make extremely detail-oriented universes. But is there a point where you decide to stop worrying over in detail things and actually get on with the story?
The question was when I'm doing when I'm developing a world, at what level does my nerdishness stop? it's an iceberg question. I need to know, 9/10 of what I know is below the water to give it this feel of being convincing to you. I don't go to extreme lengths. I will generalize, and then if there's sort of like extra scenes, if you like, set on that world, I will develop it a little more. But once I've got the basics, the sort of level of technology, the kind of economics, what politics are possible, who's running from it, who's going to it, that kind of thing, I'm fairly satisfied. So it'll be, in physical terms, it'll probably be a couple of pages, no more than that. The rest I can fill in for myself when I'm writing it. But I do have to convince myself that the world would work. I have to get those fundamentals right.
Like a turning point when you feel like you've satisfied the level of depth that has?
Yeah, when I sort of worked out the main, the government and start putting in names of assistant secretaries, okay, Peter, you've done enough now, let's stop. The same with continents, and then you start naming towns that you're not going to visit, okay, stop again. It's that kind of detail, that excessive detail. And this is a problem for all authors, is what level do you stop putting your research in the book? I've spent 2 weeks looking up this science, boy, you're going to find out about it. No, just keep it fairly simple and fairly, give you the confidence that I know it's right. It's a balanced thing. I can't spend too much time on one specific world. If it's a key and critical world and half the book takes place on it, then it'll probably be 5 or 6 or 7 pages. But that's kind of the limit.
You're talking about audiobooks there. In other media, if one of your properties could be turned into a movie or a TV show, which one do you think would work best in that medium?
You've waited 50 minutes to ask that. Well done. Watch out over the next couple of months. There may well be an announcement on that. Let me also say this, Hollywood is unbelievably slow. They don't call it development hell for nothing. That is a true and accurate phrase, okay? We're hopefully going to move to pilot pre-production before the end of the year. And that, I never said that, okay?
We heard nothing. Yes, sir.
You talk a lot about how technology affects society and vice versa and stuff, and you've introduced a whole array of, you get very creative, advanced technologies out there, from Aegis habitats and bionics and nanotics and Gaia field and stuff. Is there any one piece you would like to see come to fruition in the real world?
I actually think the Aegis habitats would be quite sensational. I think that would be quite fabulous. I think, again, I slightly over-egged it. I mean, they have what I call starscrapers, like a Manhattan wrapped around the outside that you could look out through. What we know about radiation in outer space, that's probably a no. But even so, they would be quite something. And it would be, I'm getting utopian here, it would be such a boon to us to have that kind of thing available, because we are crammed together on this world. I mean, we're seeing it in Europe and Syria at the moment. If we could just expand a bit, there's that line is always by land because they aren't making any more of it. If we could find somewhere to let off steam to just expand out there. I grew up, you can tell this, I grew up when the moon landings were taking part, followed by Skylab, and that had quite a big effect on me. And then it stopped, which was a magnificent shame as far as I'm concerned. I know that it was all run by politics, but we were given such a glimpse of what we can possibly do that I think that... People ask me what my influences are and expect me to say authors. But I think that period I grew up in was also had a huge effect on my outlook on life.
Hi. It's ironic that you mentioned the possibility of a television show, because my question is kind of related to that. You've recently seen a lot of authors' popular works go the television or movie route. And when I was actually originally reading the Commonwealth series, the thought occurred to me this would actually seem to adapt itself pretty well, because it's had multiple interesting characters and, you know, kind of action-oriented, you know, pretty badass scenes in there. So I was wondering what you thought maybe your approach should be to helping, because there's always going to be some condensing, some edges recently that came off, or, you know, how, what your approach to that would be with wanting to work.
I would be one of the creative consultants. Writing for television, writing for radio, or writing for film, is a very different art to writing a book. If you go and analyse a film, which is a terrible thing to do, and I can't stop doing it, the stories aren't actually incredibly simple. If you take Aliens, which is the classic, is they go to the world, they go further through the world, and then they retreat. And that's it. You find out new section, come back. To boil it down to that. The kind of stuff I deal with, which has these multi-layered, multi-character, multi-world things, does not lend itself to even a three-hour film. It would have to be told through television. And we are in, as everybody knows, the golden age of television. So it gives authors like me a lot of hope. As opposed to how much influence I would want, I'm going to trust the experts on that. I will be involved consulting. I'm not going to be totally nerdish and say, no, that should be green. I'm not going to go down to that level. But I hopefully will have a say in it, a bit of a say. But I think that the script writing is a very different art to what I do. The sad thing being is that if I was a script writer, I wouldn't be able to write my next books, which I really want to do, because I want to do something different and new. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Kind of leads to my question.
Okay.
About worlds and universes. I asked you this yesterday, but this was better for others. The Commonwealth universe, Einstein, and even the universe in Great World of Road. Would we see more of some of those universes, or is something new in the hatching?
Okay. Commonwealth, for those of you who are up to date on that, the last book out was Abyss Beyond Dreams. I handed in the manuscript for Night Without Stars last week. Yeah. Do not ask me when it's going to come out. It will come out next year. It now goes into editing. It now goes into designing the cover and finding a slot in the schedule and all the boring commercial stuff. It will be out next year. That is now 7 books, 80 if you count my Spent Youth, which is a little bit of a preview. Which are about 1,000 pages long each. I think that's enough. Night's Dawn, I have always said never say never. If I was going to go back to the Night's Dawn universe, and believe me, when I finished it, it took 6.5 years to write, and I just went at the end of it. I will not say no. I will say I would have to have a valid reason for doing it. I would have to have a very good plot line, a very good story to do so. And I was talking to this, we were talking about this the other day, and there are some very gruesome parts in that. And I'm not sure I can actually do it. I have kids now. I killed off a lot of kids in that book, didn't I?
Quite a few, actually.
I'm not quite sure I could do that nowadays. I'm a little bit more sensitive. But I'm not saying no, but don't hold your breath. I have no plans to go back there at the moment. As I say, if I come up with a good plot line, then I will go straight there. I've written a children's book trilogy. The first one is covered. It's a fantasy. That is a straight out magical fantasy for mid-graders. I think it's going to come out here possibly next year. We're dealing with that. I am putting together an idea for something completely new again. I have to do something different every now and then because I don't want to be associated with just one thing. I know I'm always going to be, the obituary is going to read Peter Hamilton, who wrote Reality Dysfunction and other stuff. Fine, I accept that. But I have to do something different. It is coming together slowly. When I get home next week, I will start doing notes, and that will lead to the development of the book. I can't really be more specific than that because it's just a very vague, nebulous idea. But it will be something different again. It won't. Grey North Road, no, that will not be revisited. That finished. That was a one-off. We had a little glimpse into the far future. That's your lot. Okay? Thank you.
So you want to try to get one last minute in, or are we?
I think we've got about a minute.
All right, one last one.
Go.
Okay.
Do you have a favorite character of all the hundreds that you've created?
Of all the hundreds? The fun one to write is Gore, because getting back into the politics, he and I would not agree. That would be quite a loud bar argument. But as I said before, he allowed me to let loose my inner demon, which is always great fun to write. Paula is interesting to write. I do like Ozzy. Can I have a top five? Joshua, actually, although he starts off as a complete a-hole, comes good in the end, which is always a great character arc to write. And possibly Melanie as well, who is slightly weirder than you think. So I'll stick with those. Oh, and actually Sid, my everyman policeman. That's even why I called him Sid, because you can't get a more basic name than that. Sid Hurst, wasn't it? Sid Hurst?
Hurst?
Sid. Sid. I like writing Sid. He was quite
good. He's so every man, we can't even...
Somebody reviewed that, somebody I know, and pointed out that he spends an awful lot of time, because he's a family man with two kids, and basically spends all his time wondering how he's going to get any decent sleep and whether he's going to buy school clothes. I mean, is it Hamilton's obviously going through a midlife crisis? I will actually own up to that, because that's kind of what I go through every day at home. So, oh... We've got to go. Goodbye.
Goodbye. All right.
Goodbye.
One more. Oh, no, we're done. It's 5 o'clock. Peter, thank you so much
for
sharing your time with us.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.